Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Isger, joined by Steve Hayes. And this week, we are talking to Klon Kitchen. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a former national security advisor to Senator Ben Sasse, a 15-year veteran of the intelligence community, and the author of the fantastic newsletter, The Kitchen Sink. That's S-Y-N-C. It is fabulous. And this week, we are talking China. Let's dive right in. You wrote a piece for the Dispatch, actually, and you asked a few questions to yourself that I would like to pose back to you from yourself. And perhaps you can catch us up on a little of the news coming out of China in the last week. What does this hypersonic missile test capability mean for the balance of power between the United States and China? Are we now officially in a Cold War? And are U.S. companies and technologies assisting China's military rise? Were just some of the questions you asked. So let's just dive into your thoughts on China.
Yeah. So with the recent hypersonic missile test, the reporting is unclear. And so it's a little difficult to assess the actual kind of capabilities impact of all this. There's some sense that there was some novel thing about this approach that the Chinese did, but it's not been made clear what it really is. We can get into more technical details if you like as we talk about it, but I think the best way to understand it is, like, from a technical standpoint, this isn't new, but it is important, right? So this is a capability but that the United States and Russia and other countries have been pursuing for a while, so it's not a surprise that the Chinese were doing this. They do seem to have done something peculiar. Again, I don't know what that is, that got our attention. But what I think it illustrates more broadly, and this goes to the Cold War question, is that the U.S. and China are definitely assuming more aggressive postures toward one another, and that one of the implications of that is a technological and military, you know, arms race, for lack of a better word. And hypersonics are attractive because they will help a military overcome missile defense systems, particularly the way the United States has built theirs. And so it's not really a surprise that China would be pursuing that. If you want to call this a Cold War, I think you can. Cold War is not really a technical term. It's just something that we've used to refer to the 46 years or so of confrontation and low-level conflict between the United States and China. But again, I think the underlying point is that the relationship between the United States has materially changed. For a long time, we made a cosmic bet that if we deepened our economic integration, that would lead to domestic freedom inside China. That was a fine bet. That wasn't Pollyannish. It was a good thought, but it's proven, I think, to have been a failure. And so we're definitely in something. As it regards China, we're definitely moving toward a more confrontational and sustained. The postures between the two nations are more confrontational, and that has all kinds of ripple effects down policy.
So, to use the old Facebook relationship status, it's complicated.
It's complicated. That's right.
Okay, real quick, maybe I am a technical nerd, or maybe I'm actually the opposite. But can you explain real quick? We've talked about supersonic jets and things, and then now this is a hypersonic missile. What is the distinction we're making between the two?
Hyper's just cooler than super.
Got it. Yes. Okay.
So when we talk about hypersonic vehicles, what we're talking about are things that are going typically five times the speed of sound. And there's three kind of platforms or capabilities when we talk about hypersonics. The first one is a hypersonic cruise missile, which is just an air launch. It's a missile, right? It flies in the atmosphere. It's got an engine. It uses what's called a scramjet engine. And it's just like a cruise missile. It just goes faster, right? The second thing is what we call a fractional orbital bomb or FOB. What that does is it's a... there's a missile launch. It takes the hypersonic vehicle into space. It releases that vehicle, and then the vehicle kind of bounces off of the Earth's atmosphere until it comes, you know, essentially above its target, and then it enters what's called a terminal trajectory onto its target. But the interesting thing there is that because it bounces off of the Earth's atmosphere, it's able to kind of go longer distances. All right. The other one is a hypersonic glide vehicle. The difference there is it doesn't bounce off the atmosphere. It reenters the atmosphere and essentially glides to its target, but is able to maneuver, right? So the big difference between all three of these things and, say, an intercontinental ballistic missile is the maneuverability part. So an ICBM essentially has a parabolic or, you know, an up and down trajectory. Hypersonics are able to maneuver. They tend to hide in the atmosphere, which means it's really hard to detect with radar, and their maneuverability makes it much more to intercept. Okay. The weird thing, so those are the three kind of hypersonic things. The weird thing about what happened with China is recently is maybe they kind of combined aspects of the FOB, that fractional orbital piece, and a traditional glide vehicle, which from a technical standpoint would be pretty impressive just from like a systems integration perspective. But in terms of actually building new capability, it doesn't really get you much. So it's like a really, really sophisticated mouse trap, but it doesn't necessarily kill the mouse more effectively. So with the way press reporting is on all this right now, it's unclear what happened. It's gotten everybody's attention, and people like me are trying to figure it out.
And just real quick follow-up, and how do all three of those defeat traditional defense mechanisms? Yep.
So when we talk about missile defense, well, number one, the United States is the only one who's really deployed a missile defense system like at the level we have. And at the end of the day, you're trying to shoot a bullet with a bullet, right? So that's really hard. We've gotten better at it, but even our system is, you know, iffy. With an ICBM, because of its kind of fixed trajectories, it's much easier to detect and to kind of predict where it's going to be and then intercept. The maneuverability of hypersonics makes that a billion times harder, right? Because there's no way to kind of predict where it's moving. And again, because at the most critical phase, it's operating within the Earth's atmosphere, which means it essentially uses the Earth's horizon to hide it from ground-based radar, which is what our system depends on. And then finally, with the FOB system specifically, you could theoretically travel far enough to where all of our missile defense systems are pointed at the North Pole, but this would allow the Chinese potentially at least to launch one of those through the South Pole, where we have much less coverage.
Steve, I want to spend the rest of the podcast on this. We'll go into some quantum computing. Like, forget China. I've changed my mind. All right. Kind of kidding. You can go.
We can have him back.
Okay.
A lot of the headlines about this alleged hypersonic capability related to the ability to deliver nuclear weapons. And those are headlines for a reason. That's really scary anytime you're talking about that kind of a potential leap in nuclear weapons delivery. But these missiles would undoubtedly have significant conventional weapons capabilities and importance as well. Is that right? And if that is, how should we think about the potential use cases in conventional weaponry?
Yeah, so with a lot of these things, and certainly this is the case with hypersonics, it's not that it does anything unique, right? I mean, there's lots of ways that a nuke can be delivered. There's lots of ways that you can blow up things with more traditional means. I think the big takeaway is that China appears to be diversifying the ways it can do this. And this is very much a system tailored to overcome a strategic capability that we have in missile defense, right? So the fact that they exceed our capability potentially on hypersonics, generally speaking, that's not a good thing just because of what it says about their ability to innovate and you know, kind of vis-a-vis our abilities. That being said, it's not a category it's not a categorical change for them. It's that, okay, the depth of their ability to imperil U.S. interests and people is growing. And that's a problem, given that broader political context that I was describing. But, you know, I mean, they've still got nuclear ICBM carrying submarines that can park off our coast, and they are hard to find. They've got intercontinental ballistic missiles. So a lot of people, the conversation so far is kind of divided between people who are saying, oh my gosh, this is Sputnik, you know, red lights flashing, everybody kind of run. And the other group, which is kind of a reaction to all that, which says, look, this is no big deal, right? This doesn't categorically change anything. And I, you know, as often as the case, I'm kind of landing in the middle and saying, like, no, it's not novel. It is important. And it's important because of kind of what it implies more broadly. That being said, you know, if they were to continue, they did something. You know, the reporting says that they somehow defied the laws of physics. And it's hard to assess the import of that, not knowing what that really means. And so they did something that got our attention, and I would love to know what that is.
Yeah, there's a series of comments from Professor Caitlin Talmadge, Georgetown professor, a Brookings Institution fellow, and she says China's been engaging both quantitative nuclear expansion, nuclear silos, as well as qualitative improvements. This isn't surprising given their power. More surprising is that it hadn't happened actually. And then this is, I think, the key part. But improvements to China's nuclear arsenal today come against a backdrop of worsening relationship with the U.S. and other powers, threatening behavior towards neighbors, especially Taiwan, and tremendous growth in Chinese conventional forces. And then this is the kicker. China is not gearing up for some kind of bolt from the blue nuclear strike against U.S., but it looks a lot like China wants to be sure that the U.S. can't use nuclear weapons to coerce China in a conventional crisis or war that China might start or stumble into. Does that get at the context that you're talking about?
Yeah, it does. And I'll tell you, so I'm gonna give you a scenario, and I want to be clear of what this is me kind of blue skying thinking. There's probably problems with this, but I'll give you an example that I think illustrates her point. If China were able to build a hypersonic vehicle, a nuclear capable hypersonic vehicle that could loiter in the Earth's atmosphere, so not leave the atmosphere, but actually kind of circle the Earth indefinitely and then be, you know, kind of pushed onto a target when they wanted to, you could imagine that Beijing decides, okay, we're going to move against Taiwan, but before we do, we're going to launch that vehicle and put it in atmosphere and have it circling. And the U.S. is going to know that it's there, but they won't know where it is at any given time in the atmosphere. And that's just kind of a little bit of a loaded gun, like, okay, we're going to make this move now on Taiwan. You're going to have to now factor the fact that we have a deployed nuclear weapon in the Earth's atmosphere that we can use if things really go sideways. Now, again, I'm not saying that's their intent. I'm not even saying that that's the capability they've achieved. But it's the kind of thing that goes to, I think, the point that the Brookings scholar that you referenced there was making, is that Beijing is seeking to build its strategic depth and its kind of freedom of movement as it regards the policies it wants to pursue, and preventing the United States from being able to coerce it and compel it into things it doesn't want to do.
Yeah, well, and if that scenario that you just laid out were to come to pass, it dramatically changes the U.S. calculus in virtually every respect, because, I mean, it is a loaded gun scenario, and you can't, in terms of nuclear diplomacy, make the assumption that China would be bluffing on something like Taiwan. How much, again, a context question here. I mean, she made reference to belligerent moves on Taiwan. We've seen the news on additional silos. We've seen sort of incredibly hostile rhetoric coming from senior Chinese military national security officials, the kind of hostile rhetoric I don't think has quite penetrated here in the U.S. I mean, the things that they are saying are incredibly aggressive. How much, you know, as somebody who spent a lot of time in the intelligence world, how much does the intelligence community pay attention to rhetoric like that, public source information more broadly? And how much should we pay attention to that?
Well, I think you always pay attention to it. It's a matter of how much weight it's given in the assessment, right? So to the degree that it lines up with what you're seeing in other reporting channels, you know, and it's confirmatory, well, then you say, okay, well, we need to listen to them. This makes sense. If it's 180 degrees out from what you're seeing in other reporting channels, then you go, okay, so this is either, you know, some type of a head fake or some type of public relations or public diplomacy effort, not specifically an explanation of capability. And so that's always dependent upon how good your collection posture is, right? So you have to have you have to have kind of an intellectual horizon or point of reference to hold that up against to judge its worth. That's the challenge. Now, the thing that we're facing is our collection posture in China has been degraded significantly over the last decade and a half. I mean, massive.
Because why has that happened?
Well, we have a couple of things. One, it's just gotten technically harder. Two, I say it got technically harder because in part, one of the things that happened after the Edward Snowden illegal disclosures, the Chinese got a hold of what we were doing and how we were doing it, and they've hardened themselves significantly against it. The other thing is that we had a spy in our midst who helped the Chinese obliterate our intelligence network in China, and we're still not recovered from it. So our posture's been hurt significantly. We do have a whole, you know, category of intelligence of people who do psychological assessments on foreign leaders, who listen to what they say, who assess what it indicates from a psychological perspective and what, you know, it's always hard to know how to factor that kind of stuff in though. So I guess all the bottom line on that is my general posture on things like this is like when your enemy talks, listen. And if they're kind enough to tell you their intentions, you know, take them at their word unless you have good reason not to. I do think that there is a type of, you know, this whole wolf warrior diplomacy thing that they're doing on Twitter and more broadly. I think they are convinced that they can stand up to the United States in a way that they could not previously. I think there is a growing awareness or sense within the Chinese military that of their growing capability and power. And I think they think that means they don't have to be pushed around. But a lot of, you know, my colleagues at AI, two people who know more about this than I ever will, you know, on the one hand, there's senior fellow Oriana Schuyler Maestro, who says China's ascendant. And, you know, they could make a move on Taiwan in the next 5 to 10 years because they seem, if you look at their reporting, to be concluding that they can do it militarily. They actually think they can actually pull it off. And so that makes them more dangerous. And then on the other side of this spectrum is my other colleague, Hal Brands, who says, no, China's actually a peak. They've already peaked and they're on their inevitable decline. But that makes them more scary right now, too, because they understand their window of opportunity is closing and that, you know, they're likely to be more aggressive in the near to midterm because of that.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Turning a little bit to the domestic side of this, you have Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, giving what was an odd statement. I'm going to read the whole thing because I think context is important. I can say and echo what he said, which is generally speaking, we have made clear our concern about the military capabilities that the PRC continues to pursue, and we've been consistent in our approach with China. We welcome stiff competition, but we do not want that competition to veer into conflict, and that is certainly what we convey privately as well. So the guys and I talked about this on Wednesday, and basically no one could defend we welcome stiff competition to a potential or current military rival. Can you steel man that a little for us? Can you give us some version of why that might be okay to say?
Nope. Nope. That to me is such a, it's one of those things where I immediately want to think, okay, that was an off the cuff remark that she obviously regrets and should have made. At the same time, she's clearly reading from a notebook of talking points. So somebody thought that was a good point to make. I think it was, I hope that it doesn't actually reflect a broadly held perspective in the Biden administration. But it was unbelievably dumb and makes no sense.
So that is part of my next question. Have you seen a shift from the Trump administration to the Biden administration in terms of their attitude towards China, either because of a change of administration or a change in facts on the ground, and what that has meant for the intel community behind the scenes?
So rhetorically, well, okay. So generally speaking, I think there's been a great deal of continuity between the two administrations as it regards China. And in the early days, it was kind of nice in terms of the political rhetoric coming out of the White House had become more serious and consistent and reliable. That being said, this far into the administration, I'm not seeing a lot of there. You know, that's the problem. Like, they're talking about it and, you know, we're going to do a strategy and we're going to do a review and we're going to engage. But in terms of actual policy implementation, we're not seeing much yet. Now, if I were to give them a little bit of cover, I would say, well, there's been a number of things that have happened that would draw the resources away from some of this, whether it be Afghanistan or the ransomware and other cyber events that have occurred. So it's not like these people aren't busy. Nevertheless, I often say, you know, China is the policy that we're either going to get right or we're going to get a lot of things wrong. And so you can't just keep pushing this off and you know, kind of claiming you're busy. You got to execute. And look, I think there's some indicators that there's some real policy divides between the foreign policy and national security side of the administration and some of the economic side. We've had different parts of the administration kind of negotiating publicly about, you know, where they want to see the emphasis and what they want the general approach to be on China. And I think that confuses things. And it's the kind of thing that they need to get serious about.
We've obviously paid a lot of attention collectively to China's cyber capabilities and their ability to kind of wreak havoc. You know, in conversations that I was having before the 2020 election, when we were talking about the potential for electoral mischief, a number of people I talked to said China certainly has the capability to do serious harm to our electoral processes. But we should take some comfort in the fact that they don't think it would be in their interest to meddle in that way, in part because they benefit from our stability to a certain extent, in part because they don't want some kind of cyber intrusion, cyber attacks that could be easily attributed to China. How should we think about our vulnerability with respect to China and cyber right now?
So they're imminently capable. And they have a different strategic culture than, say, the Russians. And I think that difference helps us understand a little bit of how they approach things. So, one, we have made significant improvements since 2016 in the security of our electoral systems, the actual boxes and the counting of it. We've done a lot there. That being said, a focused enemy could still screw with that and give us headaches. But I suspect that one of the lessons learned for China and Russia, frankly, is that you don't have to do that, right? You don't have to kind of cross the line of actually changing votes to really screw with the Americans. There's so many easier ways to undermine American confidence in the legitimacy of the systems themselves. I mean, that's what we're looking at right now, right? That you don't have to actually cross the line of changing bits and bytes on any kind of a voting box. Instead, you just keep doing the propaganda efforts and seeding doubt in American electoral legitimacy, and you get, you know, all the bang for your buck with much less risk. So that's what I think the general takeaway on what's happened since 2016 is. The Russians, relative to the Chinese, part of their whole strategic culture is to show themselves as not being afraid of the Americans. And so when they go and do these computer network operations, they're typically deliberately loud, right? They want the people in the house to hear them stomping on the floor so that you're scared and you know they're around, and it makes them seem, you know, omnipresent and big. The Chinese typically don't operate that way. They're much more stealthy. They tend to try to build advantage for the sake of leveraging it later. But the underlying reality of it all is that in cyber, you know, the American capability is just nuanced and sophisticated and elegant. I mean, our cyber ninjas are just amazing. But you don't have to be that elegant to be effective. And while the Chinese certainly are, the key capability that they offer that no one really holds a candle to is just scale. They just have more operators than anybody else, and they're just able to flood the zone in a way that, frankly, we and no one else can.
You anticipated my next question. I mean, that just talking to people who know loads about this more than I do, the one thing that, and this is going back several years, that has sort of stuck with me is that they sort of live everywhere. And this is true not only in our government networks, and we've seen the results of that, but also in the private sector. I was having a conversation with someone who worked in cybersecurity for a big bank several years ago. And this person said, it used to be the case that we did everything we could to keep the Chinese out. But we crossed a threshold at one point where we recognized that that was a losing battle. We couldn't do that. So now we understand and sort of recognize that they live in our systems. And we try to do everything we can to keep them from extracting information, causing damage while they're inside. Is that the right way to think about that? That was a couple of years ago. Is that an outdated way of looking at it, or is that an apt description of where these private sector battles are right now?
Yeah, so this is the genesis of what's called zero trust networking. It's the idea of like, look, the enemy, the barriers to entry are so low, and all of the freedom of movement benefits the enemy, not the defender. And so we're trying to develop networking strategies that are predicated on the notion of, okay, assume I'm compromised. Okay, how do I secure myself then? The Chinese have been a huge part of it. Now, the reason why it seems like they live everywhere is because they live everywhere. Right. I mean, just in terms of scale of operations, it's unbelievable. But what that means for us is we're just not in a position to outcompete them on scale like that. And that's why the United States is tending toward AI-enabled cybersecurity defenses. It's why we're automating a lot of this threat hunting, threat mitigation, threat removal, that kind of thing. And those are far from, you know, kind of being ready, but it's something that the threat demands of us, and that's where you're seeing industry lead out, frankly, because they're being hit, as you said. And all of this, there used to be a Chinese strategy called the thousand grains of sand strategy, where the idea was they were going after any and all pieces of data that they could, with the understanding that it was all relevant, no matter what it was, and that it could be pulled into a mosaic of intelligence that they could use, you know, at some point in the future. That, in the modern sense now, is they're going after highly encrypted information that they can't necessarily crack right now, but still hoovering it up based on the presupposition that future computing capabilities like quantum and other things will allow them to leverage that material in the future. So right now it's get everything you can while you can, figure out how to use it later. And so, you know, a lot of people will say, well, why would the Chinese want my Equifax score, or why would they want my Anthem insurance information? What are they going to do with that? Well, maybe they don't know yet, but I can tell you, if you gave me that access, I could do a lot of damage with it. And so that, I think, helps us understand their approach to it.
Well, that was maybe the most terrifying thing we've talked about so far, but let's see if we can't do better. Looking forward about what Xi is really aiming toward. We've seen just this year, quite recently, this private sector crackdown that's been going on in China, which is at least credited in part with driving down some of their GDP growth of late. So we know that that is not simply growing their economy is not the end goal. By the way, amazing morning dispatch this morning. This is Thursday morning that I thought was the best write-up of sort of the big picture China thing, but it included this last part, which I was like, well, huh. And it said, even after experiencing a 3.5% downturn in 2020, the American economy remains more than 40% larger than China's and more than 500% larger on a per capita basis. And that to me put it again into a stark contrast of, Xi's point, at least in the short term, is not to overtake the American economy. And so I'm curious, therefore, that is scary to me because I understand someone who simply wants to grow their economy. I'm not sure I understand then what Xi's doing.
So this, again, is another one of those issues where China hands are a little bit divided. And I'm still wrestling with kind of where I come down on this. So one argument says that Xi is a true Leninist believer who thinks that their economy has transitioned from, you know, the utility of their form of managed capitalism and now is moving toward a more pure form of socialism, and that, you know, the rhetoric surrounding social justice and economic prosperity or economic equity and things like that are now coming into play. And then if that's the case, it becomes I'm kind of here for that if that's the case, because I think it is very likely to stall the economic engine that has fueled the Chinese rise.
Wild income inequality. Like, we talk about income inequality in this country, it ain't nothing compared to what's going on in China.
Well, that's true. And simultaneously, that system over the last 40 years has moved more people into the middle class than has ever been done ever before in history. You know, so like, it's one of these weird dynamics, right? But the question is like, so if this is the case, if she's a true believer and he's making this pivot toward a more explicitly socialist model, and he does begin to kind of put a chokehold on his economy, then the question becomes like, okay, so when everything starts grinding to a halt and that begins to affect his ability to govern, what does he do, right? Does he double down on the revolution, or does he become more pragmatic and kind of open up the spigots? Okay, so that's one view and kind of the to be seen aspect of that. The other side would be articulated by my colleague, Derek Scissors, who says, look, this is a temporary crackdown, and it's all about Xi reasserting political dominance and making sure everybody understands that it doesn't matter if you're Alibaba, it doesn't matter if you're Tencent, it doesn't matter if you're one of the largest, the development companies.
Evergrande.
The point is, thank you, Evergrande, that you cannot be an alternative power center to the government, and I will crack whatever whip I need to make you understand that. So Derek argues that the best way to understand what's going on is not that there's been some type of significant long-term strategic pivot economically in China, but that this is a temporary political exercise, and that once everybody kind of understands their role again, expect Xi to, you know, start loosening the reins a little bit again. I don't know which one of those is the case. I do think that what China is trying to do is prove the feasibility of a new model of governance that marries up the wealth of their form of economic, economic capitalism with authoritarianism, the stability and security of authoritarianism, and that technology is the key variable in realizing both of those aims. And that if they can actually prove the viability of that model, I think that could easily become the chief export along China's Belt and Road Initiative. I think there would be a ton of would-be dictatorships signing up for, to be these kind of wealthy techno-totalitarian companies. And I think China would sell that in a box, right? I think they would have, we'll build your networks, we'll give you the boxes that make this all work, and we'll even give you the predatory loans to do it. So I think this is a real serious game. You know, I'm not quite sure how it's all going to play out, but I think it's real.
So at with our economy still 40% larger than theirs, we've already seen so many of our American companies react to China as a marketplace and what that has caused internally to our country. I'm curious, if they do continue to grow, which they are, at what point, what is that tipping point? It's probably not just parity. It's probably something pre-parity with our GDP. And do you have any thoughts on what that will look like for us economically?
So just to make sure I understand, in terms of if we see U.S. companies continuing to prioritize the Chinese market, what that means for us?
And the Chinese GDP grows even larger, so that maybe we're only 20% bigger, or maybe it's that we're 10% bigger. Like, where is that tipping point where our day-to-day, it's not just that we're complaining that the NBA doesn't care about the Uyghurs, it's that now the NBA doesn't care about the American market at all.
Yeah. Well, look, I would say we're already at a point where, let's not wait for that moment where that's kind of undeniable and irresistible. I would say, okay, let's just, you know, I said in the piece that I wrote for you guys, tech companies particularly, it's time to choose a flag. I mean, because of the way, and I'm a free market guy, just to be very clear, and I'm not advocating for, you know, what some people would kind of passingly call industry policy. I'm simply saying, or industrial policy, I'm simply saying that the way the Chinese government is operating introduces massive distortions into the free market economy. Those distortions not only have an economic implication, they're increasingly having a national security implication. And, you know, you can't, we can't keep enabling this. We can't absorb that. At the point where their market actually become, you know, let's say, as you said, reduces us from being 40% to 20%. Well, that's a real problem, right? I mean, like, our economic engine is one of our key capabilities that allows us to operate the way we do globally. And I think the globe, generally speaking, benefits from that. So to the degree that that influence is reduced, I think that's bad for everybody. And it's certainly bad for American interests.
Bringing the conversation full circle, I mean, there is, and you made reference to this in your piece, U.S. tech companies have played a role in the growth of Chinese military capabilities, and not an insignificant role. When you say choose a flag, talking to U.S. companies, what does that look like from a policy perspective? What's the mechanism there?
Yeah. So this is an active conversation that is, you know, difficult to navigate, because we have some first principles that are in play here that we want to be very careful with in terms of free market economics and you know, the freedom of the private sector to pursue some of these things. At the same time, when I talk about choosing a flag, what my strong preference would be that that private sector companies recognize both the economic and reputational risks that they're assuming by operating in China. So Chinese cyber and national security law makes it very clear that there's no keeping any information from the Chinese government. I mean, like, actual encryption and virtual private networks and other things that have been used in the past to hide U.S. company data in China, those are all illegal, and they have to become into compliance. And if you're not in compliance, then you're not going to be in the market. And that's just it. So, I like the ideas of shifting some of the burden to the companies themselves. So, for example, I could imagine a scenario where companies have to self-certify that none of their technologies, talent, or intellectual property is being used by the Chinese government for gross human rights violations or something like that, right? And leaving it ambiguous and not giving them, you know, kind of the discrete ways that that's going to be assessed. Just understanding that, look, at any given point, the U.S. intelligence community may assess, you know what, that algorithm you built is now, you know, moving people in Wuhan or in Xinjiang into internment camps, and we're going to hold you responsible for that. So it's just
saying, in effect, just putting them on notice, in effect, saying exactly. We're paying attention.
Exactly right.
And
exactly.
And would the consequences be threatened explicitly, or would this be something that would be best done legislatively, or is this something that happens kind of out of the public eye? I mean, apart from the reputational interest, which obviously would have to take place in the public eye?
I like the idea of an incremental approach, with legislation being kind of like the last straw. Like, if it's much better for everybody if we just come to an agreement and industry decides that they're just going to fix this or take it on, right? That being said, you know, so long as they think that money's falling out of the sky in China, they've got real challenges. And some companies are indifferent and they drive me crazy. Others, they make good, they make legitimate points. You know, they could say, like, look, you know, even if my CEO decides they're going to get out of China, their board is going to be frustrated about the fiduciary, you know, implications of that choice, and they won't be around long enough to actually implement it. That's not entirely wrong, right? That's true. And that's where maybe we can provide, and where I try to provide a little bit of that context for people to start justifying those decisions. So a lot of these companies are looking for U.S. government legislative action so they can point and say, look, I don't have a choice. So maybe we need to create that, right? But if we do that, we need to be very careful about that. Look, we're just moving into a place where all the easy decisions have been made, and the only stuff that's left is hard. And I get that. I'm not indifferent to it. But I also don't think we can ignore it just because it's hard.
And that's it seems to me, again, with somebody without tremendous expertise in this area, it seems to me like that's the stage that we're at right now, where we're just choosing not to have these conversations, more or less. They're difficult conversations. We'd rather put them off. I mean, it's, you know, it's like anything in your day-to-day life. I've got to make a difficult decision. I've got to have a difficult conversation. I'm just going to wait until tomorrow to do it. I'm going to wait until next week to do it. And then you wake up and you look, and the problem has gotten considerably worse because you haven't taken that step at a time when you can do some planning and some thinking about it.
And that's where she's actually been one of our biggest helps, right? His aggression and some of the things that he has done over the last couple of years are kind of forcing the issue in DC. So in that sense, you know, yay.
All right.
Yay. That's a happy way to end.
Yeah. We're gonna leave the China discussion at yay, with just like its own emoji. It should be at least Klon saying yay. All right. But a most important question for last: who is better at their job, Ethan Hunt or James Bond?
Both of them are completely fake and nowhere close to reality. I mean, I think just for longevity, you got to go with Bond.
Yeah, that's.
And I'm a Daniel Craig fan. I don't know him personally. I don't know what he's like as a person. But in terms of Bond, I thought his Bond is the best Bond, with Sean Connery a very close second.
Do you have a favorite fictionalized intel movie, TV show, or book that you recommend?
I hate them all. I mean, them all. Well, wow. They're just not. They're. It's. You know,
I
love
The Company. You didn't like the book The Company? Did you read that one?
I haven't read The Company. I just, anytime I read or see somebody opening or using a cell phone at CIA headquarters, I'm immediately just like, oh, okay, yeah.
This right, is- right. This was my problem with House of Cards. I was in two or three episodes and just thought, none of this is anything like Washington. Of course, that was, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, when it became, it started to look more and more like Washington. By the way, just full disclosure, I just looked up on my phone Ethan Hunt.
Oh,
I did not know who that was.
Mission Impossible. Yeah,
I did know James. I knew James Bond. I mean,
oh, okay,
give me
great
credit for that.
What most people don't know is that Washington's a lot more like Veep than it is House of Cards.
I still haven't seen Veep. I need to do that.
Thereby, I'm going to assume that Washington is a lot like Homeland, the Washington Intel community. That was really realistic. No.
Terrible.
They got some things closer to right, but it's, you know, but Intel, generally speaking, is kind of a long, boring process, right? It's rigorous, and I once heard somebody say Intel is like putting together a puzzle that's all black, with no lights on, and you're missing a piece.
Like that's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, I'd watch that movie. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Klon. This was really helpful and only a little depressing/terrifying.
No, thanks, guys.
we'll take a quick break to hear from Aura. Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And I'll tell you, not only have I given this picture frame to all the moms in my life, but I'm an only child, and it's been really fun to see my friends with siblings give this frame to their moms, and it turned into a passive-aggressive war to see which siblings can upload more pictures of their children. The Aura app is so easy. You can sit there at the end of the day while you're watching TV and just upload a couple pictures from the day and really show your brother-in-law who's boss. From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code DISPATCH at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.